the independence of Cuba from long time ago, from the 18th, 19th centuries, is a very hard situation regarding Cuba. We pay a high cost for our independence, not only now from the Americans and now from the dead times for the colonialism from the Spain at that moment. Cuba was the last colonial country that separated from Spain at that moment after the very hard fight for our independence group to fight against the Spaniard Dutch. And at that moment, at the end of the 19th century. Later than that, this kind of ability of the American to try to control the area, and they intervene in Cuba, and they get an agreement with the Spaniard without the conditions and without the knowledge and of the Cuban sites, of independence Cuban sites. So, as you're telling me, and you are very well known the Cuban history, we have later than that a series of different kind of series of the, program agreement and these kind of things that get Cuba in under interventions and in a very hard boot of the American. In many ways, regarding the situation of the agreement for a naval base on Carboneras in Cuba, that allowed the most well-known Guantanamo base in Cuba, that is illegal territory occupied by the United States, that at that moment, and they continue to say that they pay for us this space of land that they cover, very important bay, Guantanamo Bay. You know how much they pay for that, or they put in the paper that they need to pay for this land? $8. $8. $8 yearly. It's a lack of respect to the people of Cuba. It's a lack of respect to the land. It's a lack of sovereignty in this kind of way. And they try to get the promotions from the base in several ways to provoke the authorities from Cuba in order to create some details about it. And later than that, you send detention center for supposed, and they don't want to use it this kind of way. Later, they want to make a lab there, a very weird lab that nobody knows that they will put it there. And they continue with the base. Even the military people, the military sector in United States, they explain many times publicly that they don't need the base in Cuba. Right. And despite that, they continue to keep the base in Cuba. And this is the way that they want to promote this kind of things. And political during this period was very hard for us because we suffered, the population in Cuba suffered several governments linking to the United States. Cuban government, but linking to the United States government. So it's not independent. So it's we need to fight a lot. We fight, finally with the guerrilla of the commandant-in-chief Fidel Castro. Thanks, you have here the pictures, and I really appreciate that. And of course, until the triumph of the revolutions in 1959. Let me tell you, from the beginning of the triumph of the revolutions, the United States began to put sanctions against Cuba. There is a memorandum that maybe you need to study and the people need to know very well of the state subsecretary at that moment, Lester Mallory. At that moment, April 1960, that issued the policy so toward Cuba, that including very clear, they put in English that we need to put the people of Cuba suffering because Fidel Castro didn't have any oppositions and people on that. So we need to put pressure on Cuba economically, made the people hungry, made the people difficulties with salary and everything in order to overthrow Castro.
Exactly the same thing they are saying about Iran.
Exactly
the same thing.
It's the repeat the history about it, and this is the policy, real policy of the United States toward many countries in the world. This is really unbelievable. This is disgusting. Even they appear in the public papers that they consider this kind of politics in this moment. So they promote any kind of politics from that moment. We receive a lot of attacks, economically attacks, biotechnology attacks affecting our land affecting our animals, affecting everything in order to promote and to have the people hungry and these kind of things. They want to submit our people by force. And that's that they cannot do it in this moment. And they cannot. We have a little approach, the government of Obama. I have another mentality at that moment, and I try to, we get a little approach. We opened the embassies at that moment, but later than that, as you could see, I remember Che Guevara expressions that he said, we cannot, even at that moment, the beginning of the revolution, we cannot trust in the imperialism and in the United States in this small way like this. We cannot trust on that. Iran, it's a lot of betrayed in many ways recently now today. Nuclear agreement, that Mr. Trump disappeared the agreement and something that it could be good for everybody.
The interesting thing is, Mr. Ambassador, the interesting thing is that, okay, so Obama administration comes, does some certain policies with Cuba, with Iran, with other countries, goes to Russia, resets all these policies. Okay, so Trump comes and does his thing. Why is Biden administration not continuing? Biden was the vice president of Obama. Why is it? This is the problem, because people people say, oh, the Democrats are good, the Republicans are bad. No, all of them.
Yes, of course.
So this is a problem. The Biden administration is continuing the policy of Trump.
The same sanctions. No change. We don't expect nothing from Biden administrations. And let's go to see.
With his excuse, they said there was an attack and the hearing of the diplomats and these kind of stories.
Yes, they create several history in this way and try to get in against Cuba and like Iran very hard. That's what we call mediatic terrorism. And they try to promote mediatic terrorism from different kind of ways. That's why it is so important, our channels, our medias, try always to put the reality and the truth under the table in order that people try to know. Because they are so strong, no doubt, so strong in mediatic point of view. And they create this kind of things, that there's some problem with your attacks again. That's stupid in several ways. And they know that they cannot make a proof about that. Until this moment, they don't present a proof about that. But nobody take care. They put the lead of the opinion one time, and later than that, they don't say nothing else.
Because, you know, it's interesting. In America, everybody knows that whoever wants to become president, they have to win Florida. Because of the presidential system in America, the Electoral College, it's not one person, one vote. It's it's the states. And Florida is an important state. And the Cuban, the anti-Cuban, those people, Cubans in the U.S. who are anti the Cuban government have a very prominent role in southern Florida.
Some analytic people always speak that the foreign policies of the United States toward Cuba is not foreign policies, it's internal policies. Exactly. It's because they want always regarding their election process in the
United States. Because it seems that those people who, for whatever reason, have a problem with it might be even personal and family.
Yes, exactly.
They are keeping hostage the real national interest of America.
Yes, it's a small group. Let me tell you, it's a small group. Very powerful. They have a lot of money and a lot of conditions, economic point of view, and they make a lot of influence in the Congress and in the government in the United States. But there is proof on the survey that the Cuban people in Miami, Cuban people in Florida, they want a normal relationship with our country. It's the normal way to do it. But some of this kind of people, a small group, very right people, in the right sides, they have hijacking the policies toward
it. Seems the younger generation, the second generation Cubans that are in that area.
Yes, it's coming another kind of generation. Of course, in the United States, we have one big amount. Taking account the populations in Cuba, we are 11 million. We have around 2 million people living in America, in the United States, and mainly of them in Florida, of course. And they have a lot of influence. But the majority of the people, big majority of the people, they immigrate to the United States because of economic reasons. Right. Cuba is a poor country, no doubt. It's a third country, no doubt. We have a lot of problems in the point of view of the economic. And many people say normal. It's, how to say it, it's human people sometimes want to immigrate to another country. But to use these immigrations in the political point of view is the wrong things and the really bad things.
Exactly. Okay, Mr. Ambassador, before we go to maybe our main subject, which is Iran-Cuba relations, I want to ask two more questions. One is that, or I want to continue with what we were saying. I think maybe we can summarize this part of our discussion as it relates to America and Cuba, that America basically wants to punish Cuba because it doesn't like to have independent countries as its neighbors. It wants to punish Cuba because it's an independent country, and it gives hope to other countries.
Yes.
In Latin America, Cuba was very prominent during the Cold War in liberation movements, very famously in Angola, in many other countries, also Latin America. So I think maybe we can say it this way.
Yes.
It is in America's national interest to have good relations with Cuba, but it is the policy is held hostage. And on the other hand, you have this old imperialist view among the American elites that cannot handle the fact that you have a country which is their neighbor, very close neighbor, being independent and not doing what they say. So if you could please summarize this, this part
of
this.
Yes, let me tell you, I'd have a reference, and many people have publicly, people and high-level people in the United States, they said the problem with Cuba is personal. It's something crazy. And you could say that's something, how's possible politicians could say this is a personal problem against one country. We are talking 11 million people. We are not talking about nothing. We are not talking about neighbors house to house. We are talking about neighbors countries.
And Fidel Castro is no longer here. So why?
That's why that show you the real intention of them. Exactly. They want to annex Cuba to the United States.
They actually wanted to.
That's the dreams of the many people in America. And when you go and you talk to many people there, and some people that are confusing, and the other one not. But they said the Cuba belongs to the United States. Cuba belongs. No, not to be a small island. How's possible more than 60 years small island could stand up in front of the big power of the United States? So they don't could analyze that, and they don't accept it in this way. During the period of Obama and another kind of period, a lot of American goes to Cuba as a visit, as a tourism, and they could prove the reality in that one. That I consider that it could happen with the Iran too. If the people come here and they could see in the proper way the hospitality of the Iranian people, the great things of the Iranian people, the potential of this country, please, this is not confusion on that. That's why they promote and create problem. They don't want, they know very well our countries. They don't want that.
Anybody who has visited both Cuba and Iran,
yes,
whether they're American, Western, whoever, is exactly this happens to them. They come here,
yes,
and they see that all the propaganda and all the lies is completely different than what the reality
is.
Yes,
that's the point.
Exactly.
And I suppose one time the truth will come in out. The truth will tell about our countries. That is an unbelievable. We are under very hard war. This is mediated war, our country, in many ways. Technologically, you use the techno in order to produce bad things and to overthrow our governments in both countries and overthrow the conditions inside our countries.
Thank you for joining us. Until the next time on Insight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has unnecessarily and often unlawfully jailed tens of thousands of asylum seekers, many of whom have suffered severe physical and psychological abuse and discrimination, according to a report published recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Report Details Biden Administration's Cruel and Unnecessary Jailing of Asylum Seekers. Here's more on the issue. The Biden administration has unnecessarily and often unlawfully jailed tens of thousands of asylum seekers, many of whom have suffered severe physical and psychological abuse and discrimination, according to a report published recently. The Human Rights First HRF report entitled "I Am a Prisoner Here" offers a harrowing look inside the world's largest immigration detention system, one which the Biden administration uses to jail people seeking refugee protection. HRF interviewed across scores of asylum seekers and collected information on hundreds of others jailed by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, many of whom reported sexual, physical, and verbal abuse, punitive use of solitary confinement, denials of basic necessities, and medical neglect, among other mistreatment. Jailing asylum seekers is inhumane, unnecessary, and wasteful, the report notes, adding, moreover, the mass detention of asylum seekers violates U.S. legal obligations under the Refugee Convention and its protocol. In its guidelines on the use of detention, the U.N. Refugee Agency, UNHCR, states that asylum seekers should not be detained and that the use of detention is, in many instances, contrary to the norms and principles of international law. The publication notes that President Joe Biden pledged to eliminate prolonged detention and the use of for-profit immigration detention centers and uphold the legal right to seek asylum. Yet to date, DHS under the Biden administration has detained tens of thousands of asylum seekers, jailing many in newly opened or expanded facilities or in remote areas where they often face insurmountable barriers to fairly presenting their asylum claims. According to the report, asylum seekers detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, include torture survivors, political dissidents, student organizers, human rights activists, and survivors of gender-based violence. The paper claims the Biden administration is using flood enforcement priorities that continue the failed approach of past administrations by targeting people requesting protection in the United States and jailing them for prolonged periods instead of allowing them to pursue their cases while living safely with their U.S. families and communities. One refugee fleeing death threats for his political activities told HRF, "I am a prisoner here. I would rather die in my country than be jailed here." Another asylum seeker said, "We came here to a country of law, but I found my brothers in tears. I don't know what to say. I did not expect this." Under the administration's enforcement priorities guidance, DHS has separated families seeking refugee at the border, illegally subjected children to detention in adult facilities, endangered many asylum seekers, and placed people with serious medical conditions at heightened risk during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The report notes that in October 2021, a Venezuelan asylum seeker died of complications from AIDS and COVID-19 after 5 months in detention. HRF also found racial disparities in the length of asylum seekers' detention. Overall, migrants tracked by HRF were jailed for an average of 3.7 months. People from the majority black countries, however, spent an average of 27% longer behind bars. The report details racist abuse by jailers, including accounts about whipping detainees and their families like slaves and lynching them. while welcoming the administration's plan to end the deportation of migrants under Title 42, a public health provision first invoked by then-President Donald Trump under pretext of the COVID-19 pandemic, the report warns that DHS continued use of the flood enforcement priorities to jail asylum seekers as more are finally able to access U.S. asylum processes threatens to further entrench and expand the mass detention of people seeking refugee protection. Rebecca Gendelman, Associate Attorney for Refugee Protection Research at HRF and author of the report, said, as the Biden administration ends the illegal Title 42 expulsion policy, it should not perpetuate the cruel and unnecessary use of detention against people seeking refuge in this country. The government has legal authority to parole asylum seekers and other immigrants. Its choice to detain them instead endangers lives, separates families, inflicts trauma, wastes resources, and punishes people for exercising their legal right to request asylum. The report concludes that the Biden administration must alter course, stop jailing asylum seekers and treating them as enforcement priorities, use its legal authority to release them, and dismantle the unfixable U.S. immigration detention system that violates human rights law. In doing so, the administration should shift to proven case support programs run by community-based organizations and not so-called alternatives to detention that rely on punitive and intrusive electronic surveillance or effectively place asylum seekers under house arrest.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Violence at the Al-Aqsa compound has surged during the fasting month of Ramadan. It all began when dozens of Israeli military forces stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. Regime forces assaulted Muslim worshippers inside prayer halls while protecting the Israeli settlers desecrating Islam's third holiest site. So far, at least 19 Palestinians have been killed, while hundreds more have been injured in clashes with Israeli forces. This has raised concerns about a slide back into the wider Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like the one in May last year when frequent acts of violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime. But why is the Al-Aqsa compound a central point of contention in the issue of Palestine? Israel-occupied East Al-Quds, where Al-Aqsa is located, during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. It annexed the entire city in 1980 in a move never recognized by the international community. The illegal Israeli control of East Al-Quds, including the Old City, violates several principles of international law, which outlines that an occupying power does not have sovereignty in the territory it occupies. Following Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds, a delegated status quo was agreed upon, with Jordan giving Muslims the sole right to pray at Al-Aqsa and Jews at the nearby Western Wall. However, Palestinians accuse Israel of restricting Muslim worship at Al-Aqsa while not doing enough to enforce the ban on Jewish prayer at the compound and even protecting the violators. The ensuing Israeli aggression against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa compound is a flagrant violation of the status quo. Next, what has the international community done to put an end to Israeli violence against Palestinians? Well, the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes with total impunity, and the international community is silent, except for a few words of caution. The United Nations believes it suffices to express deep concern over the worsening security situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, saying it will probe into the use of force at Al-Aqsa. But is that enough? Perhaps the world's largest and most familiar international organization is too busy, preoccupied, or distracted with the Russia-Ukraine war, but the issue of Palestine deserves the same, if not more, attention since it has been ongoing for several decades. Thousands of people across the globe have taken to the streets to deplore Israeli violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and elsewhere in the occupied territories, as the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes in Palestine. In Pakistan, thousands of people took part in rallies after Friday prayers in major cities, denouncing the Israeli attacks on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque as naked terrorism and urging Islamic countries to intervene immediately to protect the sacred site and Palestinian lives. Also in Bangladesh, thousands of people demonstrated against the Israeli onslaught. Elsewhere in Jordan, the protesters called for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador and Amman's withdrawal from the Jordan-Israeli peace treaty signed in 1994. Pro-Palestinian rallies, however, have not been limited to Muslim-majority countries. Rallies were held in the U.S. as well as European capitals such as Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. The protesters called for international action, including sanctions to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and the regime's growing aggression.
And so we're on a continuous upward trend, a continuous upward surge in support for Palestine and support for the boycott and isolation of the Israeli occupation and in standing with the Palestinian resistance.
More protests have been organized in other countries worldwide. One of the many online websites promoting resistance against Israel is Samidun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, which has urged all Palestinian, Arab, and international supporters of Palestine to organize events and confront Israeli massacres and ethnic cleansing, events which are held by different organizations around the world.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there. Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help defuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital, Amman, in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries, but without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and that and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Thursday that Russian forces have won the battle for the strategic southern city of Mariupol. Russian forces appear to be in control of the city, including its important but now seriously damaged port. At a joint appearance with his defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin declared that, quote, the completion of combat work to liberate Mariupol is a success. The Russian president offered congratulations to Shoigu and Russian forces. But what is the strategic significance of the latest developments of the war? Mariupol is a major port in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. It is situated between areas held by pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that came under Russian control in 2014. Taking the city now will allow Russia to connect the two areas as it steps up its military campaign in Ukraine's east. Moscow can now secure more of the southern coastline, complete a land bridge between Russian soil and the Crimean Peninsula, and free up more troops to join the battle for Donbass, which is Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. Despite Russia's announcement of victory in Mariupol, hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians are still holding out inside a giant steel factory in the city. Russian forces have tried for weeks to dislodge them, but to no avail. The Kremlin says there is no need for Russian troops to enter the complex passageways of the sprawling Azovstal steelworks. The Russian president ordered his forces to block off the industrial area so that, quote, not even a fly can get through. Ukraine and its Western allies have disputed Russia's claim of complete victory in the city. But Moscow seems to be already looking beyond the southern city. Russian officials say the war's main objective is now capturing the mostly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Last month, Russian forces were driven away from the capital Kiev and northern Ukraine. Things will definitely not be smooth in the east either, as Western nations rush to funnel heavy arms into Ukraine to help it counter the offensive.
The Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO equipped by NATO and trained to the standards of NATO. So that is a major factor as to why the Ukrainian armed forces have put up stiff resistance to the Russian army.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced another $800 million to help Ukrainian forces fight in the east. He said this week that Washington and its allies are moving as fast as possible to provide Kiev with the weapons that it needs. According to Biden, the U.S. and its allies are facing a critical window of time where they are going to set the stage for the next phase of this war. Much is at stake in Ukraine for major world powers. The war has been widely described as an escalation of the never-ending tug of war between the West and the Russian Federation. The outcome of the conflict could have far-reaching consequences and may shift the balance of power in the region and beyond.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is entering a new phase, which is focused on eastern Ukraine as the opposing troops remain locked in combat along a 300-mile front line. The Russian Defense Ministry has given the Ukrainian forces an ultimatum to lay down their arms. Ukraine has reached a preliminary agreement with Russia to evacuate civilians. But the United States and its allies seem to be determined to prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to announce within the coming days another military aid package for Ukraine about the same size as the $800 million one announced last week. It will include artillery systems, artillery rounds, armored personnel carriers, and unmanned coastal defense boats. It would bring the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine since the Russian military offensive in February to well over $3 billion U.S. dollars. Kiev has called for additional weapons and support to stave off Moscow's new offensive in the eastern Donbas region, where Russian forces have been amassing after their withdrawal from the Ukrainian capital. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also said Canada would be sending heavy artillery and promised to provide more details. There are some reports that the U.S. is using the Ukraine conflict to prepare for wars against Russia and China. The U.S. military is training to fight in an environment heavily shaped by the Russian military campaign against Ukraine that was launched about 2 months ago. The purpose of this month's war game in California is to prepare for future wars against Russia and China. The report said the role players in the exercise at the Fort Irwin National Training Center in the Mojave Desert speak Russian. About 4,500 soldiers from the 2nd Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division are pitted against the fictional Devonian forces, the exercise's apparent stand-in for the Russians. The enemy fires rockets and missiles in the drill, all while using a sophisticated disinformation campaign to make false accusations against U.S. troops.
So I think that the United States, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. government, the officials within United States politics and economics have their head on straight enough to know that an open war with Russia is against their profit motive, is against their motive for world domination, because there simply would be no world left to dominate.
The U.S. has also warned China that it will face consequences if it helps Russia evade sanctions in its invasion of Ukraine. China has so far refrained from condemning Russia for the invasion and has said Moscow's legitimate security concerns should be taken seriously. There has also been growing tensions between Beijing and Washington and its allies in the Asia-Pacific region, including over Taiwan and the South China Sea. The Pentagon and U.S. lawmakers cited countering China in passing this year's $777.7 billion defense budget.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Even when people do not have access to an official to ask him questions and supervise his work, God is present there. Your work and service is like this. I have frequently said this to various managerial organizations of the country. I said to them that when they work an extra half an hour, no one might notice it. Even your superior may not notice it. And he will not give you a simple thank you. But God sees this. The same is true of unfulfilled obligations and wrong deeds. The statement made by the magnanimous Imam, the whole universe is present in front of God, is very important. May God raise the position of that knowledge-imbued heart. The whole universe is present in front of God. The Arabic word mazhar means a place where someone is present. God is everywhere. Wherever we are, whether we are alone or in a gathering of people, and even in our hearts, imagination, thoughts, and intentions, God the Exalted is present in all these places. The basis of responsibility is this, divine presence. This is the basis of social and political responsibility.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You must know that the decisions that you take, the signature that you sign or refuse to do, the things that you do and do not do are all done in the presence of God. And you were the watcher of what was behind them and the witness to what was hidden from them. Another point that I deem necessary to raise in this very friendly, warm, and good meeting is that even if you and I, who have certain responsibilities in the Islamic Republic, are like this in our personal lives, for instance, if we are not very careful and committed, when we enter the field of responsibility, we must be a lot more careful. For example, if you did not previously attach much significance to night prayers, recommended prayers, keeping a vigil and the like, now that you have become a manager, you must attach significance to them. You must strengthen the things that help you get connected to God. You and I must feel the presence of God when taking or abandoning an action. If this happens, then divine blessings will come pouring.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years.
in the limelight.
Although the United Nations has requested its members not to assist Israeli regime settlements on several occasions, the EU continues to trade with them, even if it recognizes that they are illegal. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Tom Morehout, a legal scholar. This article is published under the heading, EU must be pushed to ban Israeli regime settlement goods. Here's the story. One of the most important rules of international law is the obligation of states to refrain from using force unless they are acting in defense. In particular, the conquest and annexation of territories is prohibited. There are at least several long-running cases of military occupation violating sovereignty, including Western Sahara occupied by Morocco in 1975, the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and Gaza, occupied by the fake regime of Israel in 1967, and Syria's Golan Heights, occupied again by the fake regime of Israel that same year. The occupation of those territories have long been defined by the United Nations Security Council and International Court of Justice as blatant violations of international law. In Western Sahara, the Golan Heights, and Palestine, large-scale human rights violations are commonplace. In all three cases, the occupier has relocated its civilian population to settlements. According to the International Criminal Court, such colonization is a war crime. Population resettlement policy is particularly serious because it shows the objective of keeping occupied territories permanently occupied and de facto annexed. As stated by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, states have an obligation to ban imports from illegal settlements. Trading with such settlements provides them with support and implicitly involves recognition of the illegal situation. By doing so, states help perpetuate the illegal situation. For that reason, both the EU collectively and its individual governments have to stop trade with settlements. The rules must be general and applied in all cases. Yet, it is vital to be specific about what a ban on settlement goods would involve and what it would not. The law would not apply to products from people living under occupation and who are not, in principle, nationals of the occupying power. While goods from Israeli settlements would be banned, exports from Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza would be permitted. EU governments are allowed to implement a ban on settlement goods under the EU rules on imports. The ban would also not violate World Trade Law. World Trade Organization law does not apply to illegal settlements, and the law itself has exceptions allowing import bans that support international peace and stability. Current EU practices require the correct indication of the origin of imports, so-called labeling. Yet while the EU has strongly condemned the Israeli settlements, it still does business with them. Labeling is insufficient under international law. Rather, trade with illegal settlements should not be taking place at all. The fact that it does take place means countries are violating their international law obligations. Although the United Nations has requested its members not to assist Israeli settlements on several occasions, the EU continues to trade with them, even if it recognizes that they are illegal. It has been shown that EU trade with settlements has contributed directly to their expansion. In the recent past, the EU Commission has told EU governments such as Ireland that they could not stop trade with illegal settlements. The European Commission has claimed that it has power over trade policy rather than individual governments. Yet, when pushed, the European Commission would say that a ban on settlement goods would be a sanction and require a unanimous vote by EU governments to be introduced. By using convoluted arguments, the European Commission completely evaded accountability. Last year, there was a significant turnaround. The European Commission finally recognized that banning products from illegal settlements would not be a political sanction, but a trade measure, that it had the power to propose such a measure. Why did the European Commission change its position? Because it was forced to do so. After years of evading its own responsibilities, the European Commission has now officially recognized that it has the power to propose prohibitions on the importation and exportation of goods from illegal settlements. Why, then, is the EU still trading with illegal settlements? The only conclusion we can draw is that the European Commission is knowingly assisting war crimes. Under EU rules, its individual governments are allowed to stop imports for reasons of public morality and social policy. Individual governments can, therefore, ban settlement goods themselves without the need for the EU to have a common position. It is undeniable that the EU has come to a crossroads, having only partial or inconsistent respect for international law and human rights amounts to showing no respect for international law and human rights. Territorial aggression is on the rise. The world is watching. It is the European Commission's move. By signing the Citizens' Initiative, ordinary people can demand that the EU take the right decision. A simple procedure can only take 20 seconds can help end impunity for war crimes.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The 16th session of the Quds Conference for Palestinian Youth was held in Damascus. Participants discussed means of uniting Palestinians in service of their cause, hailing resistance operations in occupied Palestine and the people's uprising in the face of Israeli forces.
Our message at this conference is that Palestinian youth outside Palestine are present on the front lines, just like the youth in Quds, Gaza, and the West Bank. Palestinians are uniting. The Sword of Palestine battle reflects this unity, and this conference is one of the results of that battle.
The conference is held in parallel with the International Al-Quds Day, which was set by late Imam Khomeini on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan every year.
The message of Iran on Quds Day is that the only path for regaining Palestinian rights is resistance against the crimes of the Zionist entity. The message of Quds International Day is Islamic unity in the face of Israeli crimes. The track of normalization will not affect regaining Palestinians' rights.
We as Palestinian, Syrian and Arab youth send a message to our people in Quds in Aqsa Mosque that we will support them until the liberation of Palestine, from the sea to the river. Thanks to the Resistance Alliance, today we are more capable of triumphing. And as Imam Khamenei said, Quds will remain the axis.
The final communique called for national unity among all Palestinian factions, as well as re-establishing the PLO with a national plan based on resistance against the Israeli enemy. Events like this reiterate that Palestinian refugees across the world will never give up their right of repatriation. It's a message to Israel that their struggle will never stop until ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been re-elected in a comfortable victory, defeating the National Rally's Marine Le Pen, just like in 2017. 6 years after Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, France has still not had a shock victory which opposes right-wing economics and globalization. Macron's victory will be celebrated by high finance in Brussels and by the so-called bourgeois bloc, who are his core supporters. However, the Yellow Vests have said for months that they view a Macron victory as intolerable and as a call to social battle.
We had 3 years of a struggle but couldn't get Macron out of power. It shows that there is no solution possible by the ballot, only on the streets. Many people will be quite desperate, so things could turn towards extreme social instability and maybe civil war.
Le Pen did see a major rise in support as compared with 2017. But the nationalist bloc still fell short. It seems that many voters simply could not vote in favor of even a rebranded National Front, whose far-right record goes back decades. Abstention hit 28%, the highest since 1969. Blank or purposely spoiled ballots are estimated to be an additional 12%. The populist bloc, who apparently wanted neither candidate, made their presence felt by denying Macron a convincing victory in terms of the overall electorate.
The biggest revolution to come will be philosophical and intellectual. We need a new way of thinking, a new way of being French, and we need a new France. With Le Pen or Macron, we were sure to lose our democratic rights and personal freedoms, and that's unacceptable to many.